Welcome back, folks. Thank you for joining us here, the second segment. Good to have you with us. We're speaking with Patrick LeBrun about the backstory of the upcoming film, Assassin's Creed, which is, of course, as we've detailed, based on historical events. Not the characters themselves, but a lot of the backstory to this has a basis in history. And we're, of course, specifically talking about the Assassins, or the Hashashins, this kind of interesting group of fanatical supporters, you know, to the cause at the time. And we have a number of more issues here we're going to talk about and get into, and actually try to understand a bit better, you know, what this was like and how this translated later over into the Knights Templar and this kind of group. But one of the things we didn't address, I wanted to see if you have some input on this, Patrick, is about the techniques that supposedly this group used. We talked about this idea that there was almost like cult-like conditions. There were almost an early form of mind control. I've heard, I don't know if this is true, but hashish was a part of it. Hence, that's also one of the etymological connections. Right. That they were actually implementing drugs to almost create an altered state of mind in these individuals. What do you know about their techniques and what they actually did?
Oh yeah, well, we could definitely get into both the wild rumors and tall tales that spread, and then also piercing into, and it's hard to have full knowledge about a secret society where so much was passed on orally, but we can know about with a certain clarity what they were really doing. But before we do that, I just would like, you know, I was really hoping that first hour would bring in some new people, some new listeners who were interested in the movie or interested in the games and clicked on this by chance to hear about the backstory, and that we could then draw them in to Red Ice. If that's your case, dear listener, please write a little note, whether it's on YouTube or on Red Ice's site, because I would just really love to know that happened. It would really be a confidence booster, make me
put
happy.
Put a comment in the member section. Yeah, exactly. If you got in there.
And it would be an improvement from being called a Mossad shill or a State Department jackass or something like this. Some of the other comments I had. I read these at first, and actually it's funny. My first reaction is kind of a gut reaction. Is like, man, you know, how could they say that about me? You know, I write at Countercurrents, and they should listen to our talk about, you know, Jewish demographics and destiny. Yeah. But then, you know, I calm myself down and I think, you know, I'm glad that they have that skepticism, and you know that they are that hardcore on really pointing the finger at who's in power. And because that's the only way we'll have any change, really, is that everyone has to take a stand and not pussyfoot around, as it were, about, you know, who it is that's running the show and frankly running the replacement of our people. Yeah. You know, the invasion of Europe that's happening right now. It's it's a very serious time. So I at first I have a negative reaction, and I think, well, you know, it's better than. then not that this kind of attitude exists. But yeah, returning to the topic at hand, I mean, you know, and again, this is kind of a throwback to, you know, old school Red Ice Radio here. I mean, we're talking about medieval MK Ultra type stuff here, right? The old man of the mountain in Syria, the missionaries, the DA apostrophe I that they have, who's working for the imam, whether the imam is public at that time or in occultation, who's hidden at that time. You have these Dai going out and working on his behalf and creating these hierarchical schools and these, you know, levels of mystery and initiation for the people that they draw in. And I'll start first with the most lurid tale of all that came to Europe via Marco Polo. And this is when Europeans first heard about this. And they heard this about Alamut, which is the mountain fortress, so the central fortress in a series of mountaintop fortresses they had throughout a very rough area of Persia. And that is that the farm boys, right, in this very forgotten corner of the earth, who had very little education, very little awareness of the world around them, would be brought in for speech by this incredibly charismatic person, right? This the Dai, the old man of the mountain, or Hassan Isaba, who is the founder of the Alamut fortress and stronghold that they had. And he would give a speech about the glories of paradise, and that paradise awaits those who serve the Imam. And as he's telling them this, they're given drinks that are laced with opium. And then they slowly fall asleep, these kids. And then when they come to, they're in this beautiful courtyard, right, with streams. You know, I say gutters, it sounded, but it's actual like stone-cut gutters coming in which there's flowing milk, flowing honey, flowing wine, crystal clear mountain water. And they're surrounded by some lovely ladies who are playing soft music, dancing, caressing these young guys who probably haven't known the touch of a woman. And they spend a little bit of time there until they take another sip and they're back to sleep. And they're transported back into that lecture hall while they're sleeping. And they slowly come to as presumably the same lecture about paradise is concluding. And then they turn to each other, they speak to their lecturer, and they say, Master, I saw paradise. It was there, I was there, I dreamt of it, I was transported there, it's exactly as you described it. And then they're told that, you've seen with your own eyes paradise, and you know the only way to get back there is to serve the Imam, even unto death. And then they become his devoted followers, willing to do anything. That was the story as Marco Polo told it, and something that could very well explain the level of fanaticism and the willingness to go into certain death. I mean, the method that they would use often for assassination was, not the Lucretia Borgia way of a little bit of poison in a hidden compartment of your ring slipped into someone's drink, right? These guys would stab a guy in the middle of the day and say a message from Hassan Isaba, right? And then stand there, dagger in hand, waiting to be arrested. And then they're not waiting to be read their Miranda rights, to sit around in a cell for 2 years until a trial, right? It is certain torture and torture unto death. And they would face this with great willingness. Because they knew that, they're going back to paradise, milk, honey, lovely ladies, some wine. Now, unfortunately for us, and those who love these kind of stories, it seems that that version of the tale is not the true one. When at the fall of the Alamut period, so we talked about, earlier, the early Shia, under the oppression of the Sunni caliphs in the beginning, right? We talked about the hidden school that they had in Baghdad, and then through this diplomatic connivance, working even with Bulgarians, they managed to carve out space in the Mediterranean and then working their way to Egypt, having this great empire, the Fatimid Empire and their golden age. That fell to the Sunnis, and then they find themselves in these mountain outposts. And that as well fell eventually, the mountain outposts. And when it fell, their libraries were scoured by some of their enemies. And their grounds were scoured as well before they were destroyed. And no account matching the Marco Polo account comes to us from that. And also archaeologists in Iran have been working through these areas. And they have said there's no way that they were pumping through milk and honey and wine from what they've seen in the structures there. So, however, and I should say too, the chief archaeologist in Iran who's doing that research is actually a female. And so, I think given the choice before birth, I would undoubtedly choose to be, American or French or Swedish, right, rather than being born in that part of the world. But if we had the choice to be Saudi or Persian, I think whatever station we had in life, male or female or religious majority, we'd much rather be in a place like Iran or Syria, right, than to be in Saudi Arabia. It's yeah, just the way it is. But the there certainly was a serious level of charisma on the part of these Dai, these leaders. And there was also a system of initiation that they had that was bent on making the initiate very pliable. And it required very serious dedication to their teacher. You know, almost the Hindus would call it the guru diksha relationship, or they have a similar kind in Sufism, right? Where there's this deep, deep connection between the student and the teacher. And then, however, when they pass from one level to another, they have another teacher, and they're prepared for the idea that that other teacher will have even higher learning, right? Is even superior to their current teacher. The previous teacher will say this, right? And then the new teacher on the new level will teach them something entirely different, right? And so they're kind of being bounced around mentally between different positions to the point where they don't know what to believe, but all that remains is they must trust the hierarchy.
Yeah, and that actually comes out through some of the Masonic networks as well. You know, that this idea that, you know, your previous level of initiation, when you get to the next one, you just, forget all that previous you learned. That's just bull crap, you know?
Right, right. It's false interpretations of a symbol. Now we're going to teach you the real one. The next step, this is other symbol. It's the real one. Yeah. And, yeah, a peeling back of the onion, but it's, you go from a green onion to white and then red and then purple and from each layer to layer. It's something entirely different. And so as they go from level to level, as they're rising through the hierarchy, they're kind of being bounced back and forth from one worldview to another. They go through a period of antinomianism, where it's kind of a satanic inversion, right? They go through a period of atheism even. And then finally they go through a period where it really is about service to the Imam himself, and this is the gateway to heaven, which is kind of also what is implied earlier on, depending on the movement they're in. If it's a Sufi order that's nominally Sunni, they wouldn't find that out until the very end, right? But this brings us back to the game, and this is one of the revelations that they have that is certainly upsetting to Ismailis, modern-day Ismailis. They don't like people hearing this, but it is definitely historically accurate. Let's have a listen to the old master himself.
Before you go, I have a question for you.
Of course.
What is the truth?
We place faith in ourselves. We see the world the way it really is, and hope that one day all mankind might see the same.
What is the world, then?
An illusion. One which we can either submit to, as most do, or transcend.
What is it to transcend?
To recognize nothing is true and everything is permitted. That laws arise not from divinity but reason. I understand now that our creed does not command us to be free. It commands us to be wise.
Yeah, nothing is true, everything is permitted. Yeah. Yep. And so that's the, this is, very esoteric stuff, right? And this is, and this also is, frankly, if you had a group of people who were fanatically devoted to this, they do secularize it a bit, because they do cut out this, this intense, intense devotion to the will of the Imam. But you can imagine the kind of power you could wield with a very small number of people, even against an army of thousands, if you have thousands of shirkers on the other side, thousands of people who are thinking about getting home to their wife and kids at the end of this, having a few dozen guys who are fanatically devoted and who care for nothing but finding death, and who are willing to not just seek a quick, easy out in the death, but are willing to learn another language, willing to learn a trade, willing to become key diplomats, to surround themselves with people they have to lie to all the time. I mean, this is why we still talk about the assassins today, because of this incredible power they were able to wield because of the level of subterfuge and dedication that they have.
Kind of, I mean, in a way, it's kind of cheesy maybe, but it's a initial kind of form of agents or double agents, or the James Bond character, right? You just super skilled in a lot of different things, and they can become all these different things. They learn and they study, And we of course, we wonder what drives them. And if it's true that it is a kind of a supernatural origin point, if they are convinced that they are doing the right thing, I think that they will remain better at what they do, right, than someone who doubts or someone who doesn't think that God is on their side, etc. The one who kind of has the righteousness of God and that supernatural power behind them, that's close to being mm-hmm. invincible, almost.
Yeah, you bet, man. Actually, you nailed it. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, if you have that, like you said, you're invincible if you feel that you have, you know, God at your back.
Even though if absolutely. It's a lie, this is the interesting thing, right? That if it's true, if the you know, I know there might be question marks about Marco Polo's story, but if there's some truth mm-hmm. to that, which is sad, right? But it's if there's a truth to the fact that you can manipulate individuals in this ability if you simply just lie to them, and if they believe the lie, mm-hmm. it becomes reality, and you can yeah. dictate reality with that lie.
Yeah, yeah. There are a kind of two schools of thought as to how he got his followers in reality. You know, I mentioned earlier on this kind of theme we see often of having, you know, merchant elites who are very well networked and loyal to each other, and then on the other edge of that pincer is the totally forgotten, totally uneducated, you know, country backwoods folks, right? So the two possibilities that are held out are, one, there would be a manipulation of, you know, ignorant farm boys, like the Marco Polo story, minus the opium dream and the, you know, the false paradise garden and all this, right? The other possibility is that, you know, when you are in these very poor agricultural communities in mountains, you see different kinds of pressures on the people, where if you're on the plains, you know, more hands are better, right? You want to have lots of kids to help you with farm labor. When you're in an area where you have very limited space to grow, you start to see things like in Central Asia. You have areas where you'll have one wife with many husbands, right? Because they need to keep fewer mouths to feed on a limited amount of land. So you'll have three brothers married to the same lady, right? And they will pass on their land to the set of sons that they have, and they'll share a wife as well. And you kind of manage the carrying capacity of the land that way and the family that way. And then, of course, the other, sadly, is infanticide. Right, or of throwing people out or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so the other possibility, the second, and I think this is the one that most historians prefer, is that it was kind of a proto-Janissary system that he set up, just as later on the Ottomans would kidnap, you know, the farm boys of the Balkans and raise them to be fanatically loyal mm-hmm. soldiers serving only the Sultan with no family ties, no other loyalties drawing them in any other direction, right? He did the same thing. He would bring in the kids whose families couldn't afford them and would raise them and educate them in the way that would turn them into these kinds of religious fanatics, figure out what are their strengths and weaknesses and where can they be taught to fit in where, and send them out to do their work. And also, you know, they were able to accomplish amazing things, but, you know, also they weren't perfect. We should say, you know, there definitely were assassins who would have been caught, and there definitely were periods of when they were in occultation where they were being attacked because the powers that be became aware of, okay, there are these people who only marry themselves, who are self-dealing in business, and who seem to be a little outside the norm in religion. They let it slip every now and then, and that would invite attack in this period of time.
It's like the eunuch, you know, guard, and there's different sects that have been like, they've tried to find beneficial people to rule different portions of society. And apparently castrating, you know, men or taking away the sex drive, you can have them basically administer a completely different part. I'm not sure if the eunuch idea rose out of Ottoman Empire or not. It was probably earlier Sumeria or something, but,
Yeah, and it was practiced in China up until the, I think the last eunuch died in the 20th
oh,
century,
really?
Actually. Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing is that, you know, and this is where, you know, having works of people like the more recent work of Kevin MacDonald, right, talking about the origins of our people, talking about the Indo-Europeans. There's a guy in France named Jean Haudry, H-A-U-D-R-Y, who's written about, a lot about this as well. There are many others. The, and of course, the great linguist, you know, who first theorized the tripartite theory of, Dumenil, D-U-S, I think it's D-U-M-E-S-N-I-L, is Georges Dumenil. He theorized this tripartite division of Indo-European, or another word for Indo-European, Aryan society, right? Where we have these, the priest, the warrior, and the merchant. And the merchants sometimes are split in two between, let's say, skilled merchants and tradesmen and the unskilled laborer. If you were to look at a place like China or a place like, Egypt when it's run by Semites, parents will willingly sell their kids into slavery, and it would be a social move up for their kids to do so.
Weird.
You know, because then it opens up all these opportunities to be working in the court, right? That is a life that would be actually better than slaving away on a farm, right? And then, of course, the other aspect, I mean, when we're talking about the Near East, especially, you know, you have all of these little sects who are, and of course, the most famous, of course, is the organized Jewish community. But you also have Armenians and Assyro-Chaldean Christians and, and Maronite Christians of Lebanon, Alawites, all these groups that are endogamous, that are self-dealing, whose first loyalty is to their religion qua clan, right? And any loyalty to higher principles of fair dealing and justice is not there. National loyalty not there. Loyalty to the sovereign not there. And so the sovereign in this kind of environment, this kind of multiracial, multisectarian, incredibly divided, diverse group, is only to play them off each other. And they have to do things like reach outside of their society, bring in slaves to actually find anyone who would be loyal. Not the kind of future I would hope for our society. I hope we stick with our Aryan ways of tripartite division, or I should say return to it, actually, because it's been destroyed. But it's a very different way. I mean, we do have a unique cocktail of groups, as scientists point out, which Kevin MacDonald's talking more about. You've got the Paleolithic, the fair dealing and just behavior that we have, it comes from this crowd, right? That he talks about. You have the Aryans coming in. You have also these the so-called Middle Eastern farmers. We shouldn't think about Arabs when we hear that, though. We should think about, also white Anatolians. Mm-hmm. But this kind of cocktail made Europe a unique place, and also I think opened up, the ceiling on our accomplishments, and you just don't have that.
And also the environment, the geography, the climate, right, is huge compared to a desert environment, and you have people developing, that's why you have even Islam. They have a crescent moon, these are night people,
right.
and we were venerations of the sun. The sun was life to us, and for them it was too hot in the daytime. They were out at night. I mean, sure, they became astronomers and things like this as a consequence, but it's almost like, as you said, it's a mirror. It's a very almost antithetical, and now of course we're seeing kind of a full implementation of that incompatibility when we have these cultures being forced together like they are today.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're not going to keep our high trust societies, unfortunately, that's for sure. And I guess to return to Alamut, they were essentially unassailable because of their own choices of their spot for geography, and also because of the psychological warfare. Early on we talked about Saladin and how he was psyched out of battle because they were so good at placing assassins near him. And the exact same thing was done with the Shahs of Persia. The only reason why the castle at Masyaf, the one in Syria, fell, and the only reason why the castle at Alamut, which was the center fell was because of the invasion of the Mongols. And I will add a bit of skepticism in here as well. So that's a period of occultation of the Imam where he's hidden for a very long time and then emerges in Alamut at a point where I have to ask the question, are we actually dealing with a descendant of Hassan Isaba, the missionary, or are we really dealing with an Imam here?
What would explain the difference there for those who don't know?
Well, so are we dealing with someone who has an unbroken line of descent from Ali and all of the Imams recognized by the Ismailis until the fall of the Fatimid Empire? Or are we dealing with someone who hijacked that that religious belief and who saw an opportunity, saw a vacuum, and filled it and said, oh, well, you know, I was actually entrusted with this young child who I raised as my own, but in fact was given to me by a servant of the last imam who needed to send him here for safekeeping, when in fact we're dealing with, you know, his own son, right? Or some, you know, something of this sort. There is definitely a lot of room in this religion for that kind of Nietzschean Zarathustra to pop in, right? And Hassan Isaba is very much that kind of character, and seeing him will his own descendants into the place of the imams and the gateways to God, right, is entirely possible. You know, it's the level of charisma and control that he had over people. It's not a big leap to imagine that he would also want such a thing and would have the temerity to do such a thing. You know, and so, you know, that ends the period of Alamut, and also around the same time, you know, we talked earlier about an important Muslim thinker in the Sunni world named al-Ghazali. Another came along around that time as well. His name is Ibn Taymiyyah. And ISIS loves this guy. All Wahhabis and Salafis, you know, see him as a proto-Wahhabi, a proto-Salafi. He was an incredibly sectarian, incredibly hateful person, and really just called for the murder of everyone who disagreed with them. You know, it's like the opening line from the Daily Show, right? If you don't believe what we tell you, believe we're going to kill you.
Right,
you
know, right. Like,
that sums up the theology of Ibn Taymiyyah, you know.
It makes it pretty simple, it's though, like, you know? Just, this is the way.
Yeah, you know, it's like when you, just today, actually, I mentioned to somebody that I was going to be doing a talk about the Ismailis, and he's a, you know, a Catholic theologian, and he was like, oh, you know, I asked him, like, have you done any studies of, you know, other religious groups? And he's like, well, you know, just a little bit, but, you know, we all worship the same God, and and really, you know, and the sons of Abraham and blah blah blah, you know. And it's like, well, you know, if you take any doctor of the church and compare it to a guy like Ibn Taymiyyah, and then tell me that we're talking about something that's at all comparable here. I mean, you know, and I'm no Catholic apologist myself. You know, I have been, you know, raised in a conservative and then, you know, traditionalist Catholic background. And I walked away from it. I'll put it this way. I walked away from it slowly and looking over my shoulder. I think a lot of people who leave Catholicism run waving their hands in the air and screaming. But I don't have that kind of bitterness, you know. I think there's a lot of good in it. But I'm not a Catholic apologist by any means. But I'm much more of a Neoplatonist, honestly. That's why I have such a soft spot, I guess, when I'm talking about the Fatimids, because they allowed Neoplatonism to survive. But, gosh, these guys like Ibn Taymiyyah, who are held up as you know, people who can help billions of the world's people approach God is a travesty for humanity that this is the case. And actually, you know, we are recording this within a month of the vehicle/knife attack that occurred at Ohio State University, right, by the Somalian. You interviewed Andrew Anglin not so long about it.
That's right.
Yeah. And I read a news story about it, and it mentioned, actually, that he went to Masjid Ibn Taymiyyah.
Oh, interesting.
In that city. And I mean, for me, like, you know, I have a pretty good, you know, understanding of a lot of these, the nuances, let's say, of Islamic culture. And so it's like when we talked in the last time about San Bernardino and the fact that Tashfin Malik, the female, went to the Lal Masjid, right? The Red Mosque, should have sent off total alarm bells. There should be there should definitely be extreme vetting, and anyone who went to that school not allowed to come even to Disneyland, right. For a day, right? And let alone, you know, coming here to marry a citizen and to stay.
And think about it too. Let's put this in perspective with what happened in the UK here not too long ago, where National Action was banned as a terrorist group. Where,
right.
as far as I know, I don't know the whole history of the group or whatever, but sure, they might have some kind of intimidating, you know, looking maybe get-togethers occasionally or whatever, uh-huh. but there's never been any violence around it. And for a government to ban a group, a political group like this, while turning a blind eye towards the most violent, you know, religion that we have coming into Europe right now, is glaring, and it has to be continued pointed out that it's like, these are actually people that are, they're murdering people. They have blood on their hands. They are beheading people. These are some of the most brutal, vicious, you know, barbarians we've ever seen. And yet our elites are just looking the other way. And in fact, they would go after us when we point this out.
Right, right. Well, on top of that too, you know, I think that, you know, if we had some kind of devil's advocate here, if we had someone who was a multiculturalist, they would say something like, well, you know, there are a lot of crappy white people too. But here's the thing. When white people murder, when white people kill, when they do these kinds of things that are happening now that Europe is being invaded, they can't point back to any foundational religious text that says they're actually doing good, not bad.
Right.
Right? Like, we agree, like, everything says in our society, like, when this will happen, we will call it bad, and they will understand they are doing bad. For this guy in Ohio, he was doing good. You know, it's if we had a, so imagine you had a new prayer group or a club at your university or something like this, and it was called the St. Francis Club. And then you had another one at another school, and it was called the Ignatius of Loyola Club, right? Well, you could probably pretty well guess that the first club is going to be about raising money and donating to the poor. The second club is going to be about, you know, intellectual discussion or spiritual exercises, meditation, these kinds of things, right? Because we understand the nuances of Christian and Catholic history, right? And the meaning of these characters. By the same token, if a new masjid opens up in your neighborhood called Ibn Taymiyyah Masjid, you should know that this kind of thing is not going to be surprising that this is the result. And that's the sad thing about the people who are promoting multiculturalism seem to be the most culturally illiterate people in the world.
They know nothing about anything. Mark Stein has pointed this out in many of his talks and things like this, you know, which is a good critique. It's like, you know, multiculturalists and those who advocate for it, it's almost like it's an excuse so that you don't have to know anything about anything, because it's all the same anyway, right? So it's just, what does it matter?
Right. Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so Ibn Taymiyyah and Muhammad al-Ghazali, I mean, these guys mark the closing of the Islamic mind. Another world was possible for them for a time, but that did not.
And this is around 12th century, something like that?
For Ibn Taymiyyah, we're talking about, that's about 200 years after al-Ghazali. So we're talking about between the beginning of the 12th century to the end, to the beginning of the 14th century. This whole process happens of, you know, you had the fall of the Fatimid Empire. They transition into being assassins, some into being Sufis, some into other esoteric schools. And you have this, at the same time you have, I mean, essentially it's kind of a back to basics for Islam, because they're going back. You know, what Ibn Taymiyyah and what Wahhabis are all about is that the first generations of Muslims around Muhammad are the best of men. And so they're going back to the basics of being these desert thugs, you know. And so and guys like Al-Ghazali, guys like Ibn Taymiyyah, give the intellectual framework in philosophy and in theology, respectively, for them to do this. And that's what's taken root, and that's what's still there. And that's what's on the ascent now. When we talk about Islam being the fastest growing religion, you know, we're talking about that kind of thing. And the challenge, as we've talked about in our talks before, is that they have this religious imperative to never criticize each other, to never make distinctions between themselves. So you will find, you know, Ismailis and others who will come to, and Sufis will come to the defense of guys like Taymiyyah or Wahhab, mm-hmm. or Wahhabis in modern times. And it's just, I mean, it seems that there is just no possibility for improvement with that attitude.
They're not asked to disavow or denounce them.
Yeah. And it's a sin if they did so. And the Quran cannot be looked at allegorically. It can only be looked at literally. We'll return to that in a little bit as we talk about developments in the Ismailis. But so basically what happened when the Alamut was destroyed was that it had to go into complete hiding again. And they started doing, you know, we've talked in previous podcasts about this as ideas to adopt for the alt-right. Is the idea of Taqiyya and Asabiyya. These were key to Shia. The first Taqiyya means that you are lying, that you are hiding what you really are. And Asabiyya means that you have a real sense of brotherhood and loyalty to each other, right? And so these became central. They went into total hiding during this period, and they stayed in the central Persia area. And throughout this time, now there is a bit of Da Vinci Code historiography, it seems, kind of mm-hmm. pops in with the Ismailis every now and then. You know, we talked about how it seems like sometimes they fake things. Rumi, who I think actually is the second best-selling foreign language poet in the United States, he was this Muslim mystic, and he was in... he's writing all this poetry. He had a muse who was a man, actually, who spent 40 days with him. And the Ismailis claim that this was the son of the last master, the last imam of Alamut. The guy had the same name. He was a smith of some kind in a city not so far, in Tabriz, actually. And that's the name is of the... He had the same name as the muse of Rumi, and it's definitely a mystery as to who that person was. Like I said, it kind of sounds like the whole Priory of Sion, who was in charge of that. It's like Leonardo da Vinci and Beethoven, and, you know, if you know anything about running organizations, like how the hell do these guys have time to make music or paint or do anything while running a secret society of hundreds of people, because it's a hell of a lot of work. To do any kind of organization, to run a school board where people can like email each other, right? Let alone an international secret society. And that's kind of like, they kind of go into that, you know, tall tale telling themselves every now and then. But they seem to have maintained the faith, a lot of them. And a lot of them are, like I said, you know, such remote areas that they just don't get news, you know? And so they continue these certain beliefs that they have. And the networks remain in place. And after, a couple hundred years, they're able to regather their wealth. And when they pay their zakat, right, their tithe, essentially, they pay it to the imam himself. So there's no decentralization whatsoever in this religion, right? There's no, like, the church flower fund and the school fund. And then you can pay Peter's pence, you know, you can pay something off to Rome as well, if you will. You know, it all goes into the exact same pot under 100% control of the imam with no transparency whatsoever. And that lasts to this day.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so, yeah, they were able to build up wealth, able to build up holdings, political connections, what have you. And so about three centuries later, they began to be politically important for the Shah. And this is now we're in the time of Aga Khan the First, right, in the 18th century. Aga Khan is what we call the current imam, right? Everyone calls him the Aga Khan. That's actually just a Persian title of nobility. So he was made a governor in eastern Persia. And I'm skipping over a lot here, but throughout this period, you know, they were found out a couple times, and they were not found out, you know, and they were hidden again, or there were some like bad business deals, and then you'd have a 12er mullah gets together a mob, and they actually killed one of the imams in his home and stole a bunch of books, and they figure out, yeah, actually these guys are Ismailis, and they've been keeping the secret for 200 years, and they, you know, they had correspondence and the proof of this. You know, so they really did keep things going in secret for so long. You know, it makes you realize that a story like the Born in Blood story, right, that the Templars hid out in Scotland, and then they orchestrated the peasant rebellion of 1380, was it 1280? The Wat Tyler mm-hmm. rebellion, right, in England. This is in a book called Born in Blood. It's dismissed by professional historians as being totally impossible that a group could remain secret for 80 years and then organize peasantry to rebel. And then also, you know, everything that was burnt down seemed to be enemies of the Templars. It was like revenge. And people were yelling things as they were doing this that were really Templary, right? And how the hell is this possible? It's not possible. It can't be. When you look eastwards and you see these kinds of secret societies who were religiously driven, who were under intense scrutiny and oppression lasting for centuries, suddenly it seems possible and plausible, right?
Yeah.
And so they emerge with the Aga Khan. He becomes a governor in eastern Persia. And he's ruling there on behalf of the Qajar Shah, Qajar dynasty, right? The Shah of Persia. And one of this guy's brothers, one of the Shah's brothers, when he took over, didn't like the fact that he was not the Shah, that his brother was. And he started a rebellion. He was organizing in modern-day Afghanistan, doing raids, creating destabilization, all this sort of thing. So this is a frontier province that's hard to manage. And so the Aga Khan is sent there. He's very well networked. He knows a lot of, you know, he's a fixer, right? So he's put there, and he does an excellent job of bringing peace, quelling rebellion, continuing trade, all these things. And he's expecting rewards and titles and money and land and all these sorts of things, which is not forthcoming. The Qajar Shah then appoints, and you know, this is the thing, they always know that these people who are descended from Ali are a threat to their consolidation of power, right? Because of this undercurrent of Shiism, right? And we're talking about people who already are Shia now in Iran. They're 12ers, not Ismaili, but they're still this, they are always a threat for those who don't have the right lineage. So they always have to be cautious about that flank. He makes a nepotistic appointment, replaces the Aga Khan. So then the Aga Khan mounts a rebellion and tries to carve out this territory that he was put in charge of. He fails to do so. He's defeated, and he's forced to return to his family seat, further in towards the center of Persia. And then he develops this plan. And this is an amazing tale that unfolds in this guy's life. He develops this plan where his wife and his mother-in-law and his mother, they're all about to go onto a Hajj. And they're going to leave, but they need to go with protection. They're wealthy, noble ladies and crossing dangerous territory and many national boundaries. And they have to be cautious about this. And then also he goes on to the imam, Aga Khan the First, he's going on a big hunting trip. And this is not sitting in a deer stand in a tree waiting for a deer to pass by with a bow and arrow. We're talking about, you know, a Persian potentate hunting trip. It's going to involve a lot of people and tents and right. all these things, right? Which means it's indistinguishable from an army on the move, right? So he has all these kind of side stories, things going on, and he eventually breaks out of his home territory with thousands of soldiers and his retinue and his family and a great deal of their wealth and their closest secret dai and missionary, right, advisors, the senior cadre of the Ismaili religion. And they try to take over that territory one more time, and they fail one more time. And then, they, instead of running back to central Persia to their certain death, they go further east into Afghanistan. And as luck would happen at that time in Herat in Afghanistan, right, in the western areas, the British are there fighting the first Anglo-Afghan War. He arrives right in the middle of it. It's not going well for the British, and he offers his services to them. But once again, that fails, right? The British fail, he fails, everything. And they retreat back to Kabul. And then the Aga Khan offers to take his family, his army to Sindh, which is part, a big chunk of Pakistan, today's Pakistan. And in that one, they successfully subdue that territory, bring total peace and calm and commerce and everything that the British love to that territory, right, in their name. And he's rewarded, as he had hoped for before, he's rewarded now by the British with land and with a great pension, with all these things, right? And he then has not the sovereignty he was seeking, but he's got a very comfortable position, right? He then makes his way down to Mumbai, modern-day Mumbai, then called Bombay. And he's, again, seeking out money. And it's, you know, it sounds like so materialistic when you hear this whole story, but there's a group of people called the Koja caste, right? 400 years before, they had converted to Ishmaelism. And a lot of them were merchants. They became merchants after they were, you know, tribe. They'd been trained up by their missionaries that came down from Alamut. And they had worked their way south towards Mumbai, and they were a wealthy merchant community. And he then, after having done this great service to the British Empire, he goes down to them and he says, I'm collecting my back taxes now, my back donations, and I'm expecting it in my bank account and treasury before the end of the month, right? And there's some dissent, naturally, especially amongst the local administrators of that community. He then takes his case before the British Empire judges, and they actually find in his favor, and they move that community and their wealth under his control. So, and he becomes an essential figure because, you know, the Ismailis are hidden around in pockets and spread all throughout Central Asia, all the way up to Tajikistan. And so when it comes to the great game, right, when it comes to this this fight between the British and the Russians over who will control Central Asia, who will control the world island, right, put it in these geopolitical terms, he is a key, indispensable man. So, you know, once again, we see this, I mean, these themes come up over and over again of this kind of pincer movement of merchant networks and the country bumpkins becoming the indispensable man to powerful people, right? And as and this and of course this unquestioning service to the imam. And now, that continued, that kind of service. The son of Aga Khan II was, the son of Aga Khan II was only there for, Aga Khan II was only in charge for about 4 years. And Aga Khan I was the first after these centuries to officially end Takiyya and to completely come out of occultation. You know, there were a few times where his ancestors were unveiled, but it was definitive with him. So Aga Khan II was only there for a few years. He passed away. Aga Khan III became the imam when he was only 8 years old. And he became an incredibly important person in the history of South Asia. He was one of the founding members of the All India Muslim League. He was a member of the Privy Council for the queen, or for the king at the time. You know, the Privy Council of the UK, which is this kind of secret central council to the sovereign. Mm-hmm. He was a founding father of Pakistan after the end of World War II and the partition of India. And in 1937, he was made the president of the League of Nations.
Oh, really?
And so, yeah. So he was just incredibly important person in terms of diplomacy, in terms of the governance of the most important part of the British Empire outside of, you know, the United Kingdom. He was key to the great game as well, just as his grandfather was. And he was also lived the life of a kind of a European playboy noble as well. You know, he was known for loving horses and gambling and women. But they seem to have this unending wealth that allows them to blow their money on stuff like that, but still have billions in the bank. He was, like I mentioned earlier, I have my background is, you know, being raised in sort of conservative and traditionalist Catholic milieu. So I have a pretty high tolerance for, gold and finery next to the religious leader, right?
Right, yeah.
But that's definitely stretched to the limits when I watched celebrations of the Aga Khan's leadership, because at his golden anniversary, when he turned 50, he's this enormously fat man. You know, he's like, it's like in the Edwardian era of England, it was like the thing. It's like you eat way too much.
It was a sign of wealth.
You go on
right,
hunting parties.
Status.
Yeah, exactly. And his followers on his golden anniversary, on his diamond jubilee as well, on his golden anniversary, they gave him twice his weight in gold. And he actually went on this huge platform and he sat on a scale.
Oh my God, really?
And he's surrounded by thousands of people who are just adulating him. And they're bringing up, you know, gold bar after gold bar. And they're just like cheering it on. And I'm just blown away. I mean, I can't believe my eyes as I'm seeing. This is actually on film. You can see this.
That's funny.
Yeah, they did the same with Diamond Jubilee and then later on with his Platinum Jubilee as well. Now, supposedly, exactly. Yes. Pimp your
my royalty.
Your vicar of God. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, now, supposedly, a lot of it goes to charity. I think they're a lot better at that now than they used to be. But we don't know how much of it is given because there's no transparency, you know, whatsoever, right? And I should also point out, you know, I haven't talked a lot about the religious beliefs and practices that they have. And so I've talked about kind of a bad side of it now, right? But I'll talk about a good side, which can also get to the point of absurdity, though. And that is that they always focus on the esoteric, almost to the point of ignoring the exoteric.
Yeah.
Right. You know, Wahhabis are just exoteric. That's it. Like Salafis are just exoteric. I think René Guénon was onto something. You know, when he said that, you know, those who are just purely exoteric, at some point they become indistinguishable between atheists. You know, because you have to wonder, like, is there anything beyond, is there any soul
right
to this at all? But with the imams and with their followers, you know, they're supposed to fast during Ramadan, right? But that's just the exoteric fast. You know, I'm actually spiritually fasting right now as well. So, and then I might be eating a feast of duck and quail and whatever with my hunting pals in Britain, but you know, esoterically, my soul is
right.
Fasting. and the same goes for, you know, these other things. And one thing that's very clear is that they, the exoteric Hajj, right, of the five, all the five pillars, they have an exoteric and esoteric. The exoteric is the Hajj, so actually going to Mecca. But that is just a simulacra for approaching God. And the esoteric Hajj is actually to go and visit the Imam. And so that's the, they'll ignore these other things that are normal for Orthodox Islam, even though they claim to be Muslims. And they'll focus instead on community, and they'll focus on these, you know, so-called esoteric ways of being Muslim. And I remember the first Ismaili I met ever, and sort of chatting with her about, and she was from a very wealthy merchant family in the southeast of Africa. And so on the southeast coastal cities of Africa, you have quite a few Ismailis who are a market dominant minority there. And they originate in, you know, Gujarat, Mumbai, these areas where they were market dominant minorities up there. And she said that first of all, the men and women sit together when they pray in the Jamaat Khana, they call it, their house of worship. They, in hers, They actually prayed and sang hymns. They actually sang as well. So men and women are sitting next to women who are singing, and they're singing in Gujarati, not in Arabic, right? And then finally, you know, when you visit the homes of these, you know, pious Ismailis, you'll see a picture of the Aga Khan up on the wall. And, you know, if you go to any Muslim's house, you'll notice that there aren't any, I mean, the only pictures you'll see are a picture of Mecca or a picture of, you know, maybe, you know, the Golden Dome, the Dome of the Rock, right? But for the most, but for the really strict ones, you know, the Wahhabis and Salafis, you'll just see Allah written in gold on a black background or something, right? I mean, it is, and the reason is because you can't have, you can't make companions to God, right? You can't make partners to God. And so if you, if you're in a room where you pray, which should be basically almost every room in the house of a pious Muslim, you can't have pictures on the wall because that creates confusion. So, to paraphrase our friends at the Daily Show here, these are levels of heresy that shouldn't even be possible, you know? Right, pictures of a guy on the wall in a room where he prays, praying Quranic verses, singing Quranic verses in another language, men and women sitting together. I mean, we're talking about something that is way, way outside of the Islamic mainstream.
Yep, that's right. You know?
And they'll all, when you talk to Ismailis, they'll always talk about this conference that happened in 2005, where all of these Muslim leaders from different sects were brought together in Amman. The Amman conference, and then they made a statement of who is a Muslim, and that includes the Ismailis, and they always, and they're the only people who talk about this thing, because they're so obviously heretics that, you know, and the rest of the Muslim world is constantly calling them out as such, that they, you know, have to like pull out this statement and wave it around all the time to remind everybody else that they're actually
Muslim.
I'm
surprised that they let them do this, though, and there was some of the biggest leaders involved in this conference that granted them to be part of the Muslim faith.
Yeah, it was a, you know, I think that it's one of those things where they choose the they counted their votes before they invited people.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, how in the hell is that possible that they could do such a thing? I mean, and it is a bit ironic. I mean, Al Azhar University in Cairo, you know, this that was built by the ancestors of the Aga Khan. That is still the center of Islamic theological learning for the Sunnis, you know, finds them to be heretics, you know. But they picked the right people, I think, and brought them there, and they got the politically expedient result that they wanted. And let's remember, you know, this is happening just shortly after the Iraq invasion, you know, not so much longer after the 9/11 attacks. The King of Jordan is very good friends with the United States and especially with the Bush family. And so I'm thinking that that had a lot to do with how this was structured. And the Aga Khan IV, you know, remains an important partner for the West in because he provides access and intelligence to Central Asia. You know, I undoubtedly he was providing intelligence throughout the process of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. You know, many of his subjects were under Soviet republics. Mm-hmm. And actually many of them were very also, you know, pro-Soviet because they were happy to have this secularizing influence because these are not people who wear hijab. These are not people who are, you know, strict about Sharia. And so I guess to kind of round out our story, I mean, they have this incredibly amazing history. They have this you know, fanatical devotion to one person that they put next to God. And then, you know, you have to ask yourself, well, why the hell do any of them stick with it?
Right.
You know? You know, it's this guy who's being weighed on a scale with his weight in gold, and it's no small number
for this guy. You're going to find that, by the way. It's hilarious.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a but I think, you know, if I were to put myself in the position of one of these folks, you know, for one, all of your family, extended family, will be in this religion, because in this part of the world, you know, there's no cafeteria aspect to religion, right? I mean, all of your family will be in the same religion, you know, and your marriage prospects will be of people from the same religion. And if you leave your religion for marriage prospects elsewhere, you're going to be kind of looked askance at. They're going to say, "Look, well, why are you? What makes you a bad whatever you are to the point where you're not marrying amongst your own? Why is no one setting you up with somebody else from your own community?" And then you think about the business aspect. We're talking about merchants here who are self-dealing in a part of the world where there's a lot of self-dealing and collusion. And so if they were to leave, they would cut all of that off. And so from a social point of view, from a family point of view, from a a business point of view, it makes sense to stick with it even despite all of these, maybe absurd things. And then when you think about it too, for much of the history of this part of the world, you can't leave that and become nothing, or you can't become a Christian, certainly, or something else. It's either that, or you're going to be part of a community that's much more serious about Sharia.
Right.
And, the number of people who, if it was put to a vote, an honest vote, and like with their, clearly obvious, like this way of life or that way of life, they don't like Sharia. It has to be forced upon them. And so, no one in the end, even though there are all these weird things they have to put up with as Ismailis, they stick with it, I think, for these very reasons that I just outlined. And so, that coupled with their, the many dedicated fanatics that they had that are very famous, but certainly not a majority of their community, and their intense cleverness at business, at diplomacy, and so on, that's what allowed them to have this incredible 1,500-year story of survival.
Very interesting. I mean, I wonder if there's any, if this is a faction that is then, not open to reform maybe, but it's not as hard-lined. Is there any reason to think that this is something that would become more and more popular since, if globalization, all these things, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that Islam as it currently exists today is kind of like it's a reaction to some of that. It's right. Trying to hold back modernity and I'm not saying necessarily that's something bad. I mean, I some people dislike Islam simply because it's not liberal enough, or it's too traditional. I guess that's a better way of saying it. In this case, would more people be maybe attracted to this form of Islam because it's more lenient and not so hardlined?
Right. I would think so, but here are some structural problems for it. You can't go in to pray. Even you and I could walk into a mosque, a typical mosque or masjid, right? Whether it's a 12 or Shia, whether it's Sunni, we can go in freely. Even a Muslim who's not a sworn member of the Ismaili sect and who is not paid up their dues, they can't go into a Jamaat Khana, their house of worship, to pray, including spouses.
Right.
Right. And so this is a big barrier to new membership. And I think socially speaking, if you're not whatever, Persian speaking descendant or Gujarati speaking descendant or whatever, I mean, they become kind of ethnic clubs, right? And on top of that, they're ethnic clubs of people who are all related to each other. So coming as a newcomer to that, I think would be, they wouldn't be welcome, even if they have the best intentions, it's hard to be welcomed with open arms in that kind of situation. That being said, the Aga Khan himself, clearly from speeches he gives, especially in Canada, he has a strong community there in Toronto, clearly wants to hold himself out as a voice of moderate Islam, as a voice of 21st century Islam. And that's the, but he's also, he remains an incredibly controversial figure for Muslims for very Muslim reasons. And that is, he's been, he kind of lives the life of a Swiss billionaire, and he actually happens to be a Swiss, a French / Swiss billionaire. So, and he looks, you look at him, his phenotype is
exactly.
White.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure. Images now is like, hey, this guy's white.
Yeah. And his father, was a playboy in Europe, and he was, his mother was a, famous, beautiful, white socialite. His son, same story, the next Aga Khan, the next imam of this community will be. I'm sure they were like jumping for joy when he was born and they saw he had black hair, because I think at this point the chance of them having a blonde is pretty high, and that would be probably disastrous for them.
Interesting.
But he's still got like a kind of a Persian look. You know, he's got like a nice pointy bottomed beard and like well trimmed and black hair. But I think that the Aga Khan sees that as hopeful. I think that, you know, if we were to wave a magic wand and instead of having 20% of the world's Muslim be Salafi, instead of 20% were this market dominant minority with some bizarre practices, but who are fine with, you know, the lifestyles we like, and then Salafis become 0.1%, you know, I would certainly make that happen.
Yeah, it's not as easy as that.
Not as easy as that. And I think ultimately, though, they will remain like the Maronites of Lebanon, like the Armenians. They will be a closed market dominant ethnic group of endogamous people. I think that'll be their future.
You know, I think we need to remember here from all of this is that Islam has been the Sunni version of Islam specifically that has been so successful because it's simple, right? Simplicity is key here. People want structure, but they want to have a simple structure. And unfortunately, it seems to be kind of just a trend in everything that we see throughout human civilization that, you know, it begins on a high note and then it just degenerates slowly, rapidly in some cases. But it's like the dumbing down process is happening everywhere. There's so many problems. And I think a lot of people are attracted to it because in a complicated world, this is something that is so simple. It's so... An intellectual person, atheists, etc., they look at this and figure no one can possibly take any of this seriously, right? But it's like there's billions of these people out there, and it's growing, you know?
Yeah, and I could totally see how, you know, you have a lot of this phenomenon in the United States of African Americans in prison becoming Muslims for a number of reasons, you know? I mean, one is they don't want to worship a white guy. Right. And for them, you know, they got these Baptist children's books, you know, Jesus is a guy with not just a white guy, but a blonde, blue-eyed guy. Right. So they don't want to do that. And then two, I mean, they're sitting there in a prison cell. They know their life sucks. They come from a totally degenerate, barbaric community. And here's an opportunity to have a fresh start, not only a fresh start, but actually a new name. Right. So they have a new name. And they have a new way of life, and they, in a way, comparatively, become civilized, and they find the order in life that a father who was not there for them never gave. Right? You know, you eat only in this way. You pray these number of times
with
a day,
his hands,
side by side.
Like, I mean, it's like I've mentioned this a couple of times on the show, but it needs to be reiterated. Mm-hmm. The rules are so. It's such a structure that is basically for robots. Mm-hmm. It's like a programming language or something, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if I told you the story. It's funny you mentioned the wiping with the hand. I actually was once in a Salafi mosque in the United States in an African-American area for reasons I can't go into.
Red flag.
And I was
just joking.
Yeah. you're right. I must be actually on a different kind of shield when everyone writes in the comments, right? And they had this tradition after a lecture, after their sermon, that they have open questions, which is it's kind of paradoxical for a group that's so hard line and seemingly autocratic, but they also have this tradition from long ago of asking questions. And there was a guy, black guy who had been in prison, who had a red dyed pointy beard, and who was talking about, he was asking this imam from Saudi Arabia all about talking to young people in his community and wanting to answer all their questions. And he says, like, I tell them that they need to only wipe with the right hand, but they ask me why. And actually, like, this guy from Saudi Arabia starts laughing at him. And he's, like, waving his hand in front of him. He's like, I don't want to talk about this in here, man. It's like... And he was like, he like even acted it out. He's like, I'm telling him to wipe with the right. And he's like reaching behind himself as he's like, I'm telling him to wipe with the right.
Oh, man.
Is that because the left, or not the right? And it was like, yeah, it was, gosh, it's hard not to laugh.
Oh, yeah.
And that was definitely not a place where I want to have inappropriate laughter.
Oh man, that's funny. That's funny. But what should what should we take away from this? What's some of the concluding thoughts? Obviously, I mean, we've opened with talking about, you know, the release of this movie, and of course, there's a true history behind this. There's something interesting, of course, with, you know, some of the undercurrents to this. What would you say? What more do we need to tie into the discussion?
Well, you know, I'd say that, I guess there's a lot of history that's just really interesting. I mean, I guess mainly it's just a fun story to tell. I mean, in some ways, there are some false starts that people could have if they were listening. You know, Bill Cooper was an amazing radio personality. I mean, pipes, like you wouldn't believe, and his great delivery. You couldn't tell the difference between when he's talking or reading. But his vision of what happened, where they're all one secret society conspiring against us, not true, entertaining but not true. The kind of James Wasserman, OTO, who's their founder?
Yeah, that guy, the Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, their thing about it being they're actually buddies is, and also probably the Theosophists feel the same way because they're all about making unity where there is none for their own globalist goals, but. It's just not the case. At the same time, with Assassin's Creed, it's a very entertaining story, this tale of these two philosophical positions, right, of freedom or control, entertaining but not true. But what we end up with is a very human tale of incredible accomplishment and of cleverness and of survival. And I hope that people don't ever come to a position like that, but at least when it comes to political movements, I think that we have something to learn from them and something to learn from so many others that we can apply to our own efforts. And now it's time for us to shine. I think this is the generation that will, the young people listening right now are the ones who will rise to the challenge. And I think we'll have and maybe a couple decades from now, it may take a while, but I think we'll have an awareness of who we are, of the unity of our people, of our race, and I think we'll throw off the shackles, both of those who are controlling us, whether they're oligarchs from our own community who sold us out, or whether it's the organized Jewish community or what have you, and certainly have kicked out our invaders by then.
Yeah.
But between now and that point, there's a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of sacrifice to be made. And so knowing what's been accomplished in the past, knowing what's possible, makes it easier for us to accomplish that. So I hope that people can be inspired by their story and other similar stories and can get to work.
And they, as you said, they will have to, we have to rise to the occasion. There's no other way around it, considering what we're up against and the threat here. But it's interesting. I think that people are attracted to these kinds of games and stories because somewhere they know this truth. They know that there's something to it, that they are intrigued by some of these ideas that we're not privy to, that we're not let into a history which is one of an undercurrent. I think people kind of miss that in their lives, and there's something interesting there because you can learn so much from it. And I thought it was interesting when you talked about their way of doing warfare at the time, considering how outnumbered they were and everything else, that there's always things that we can, we can learn from there too. And these old, maybe even ancient methods that they used to influence and change the direction of the world. Because sometimes it does feel like we're vastly outnumbered. I know that we're growing, obviously, but we're vastly outnumbered. But that should never discourage us from knowing what can be accomplished by very few people,
Absolutely. Yeah. There's nothing new under the sun.
That's right.
They say, I mean, it's, and it's definitely, we can accomplish this. It's, I guess I would want people to, it's an amazing game, amazing story, very immersive. I've only played, part two, but it's a lot of fun. But also, I guess to go back to this exoteric, esoteric, right? We can play it as an escape or as an entertainment. Just as you can, you know, if you take a trip from one city to another or you visit a site, you know, you're a tourist, right? But if you open up yourself to learning something new about how to accomplish something, or even open yourself up to spiritual ideas, you know, if you are moving from one place to another as a tourist, you can also go as a pilgrim, right? There's the exoteric and the esoteric. And the same is true for these kinds of things. You know, we can just have entertainment and escape, but with the exact same thing, the exact same subject, we can also seek out greater awareness and transformation. And so I usually avoid, you know, spirituality because I'm, you know, so focused on the political. I don't want to find division or sow division and try to avoid it wherever it could be. But, you know, everyone should have some kind of spiritual foundation in this struggle, and I think their ability to fight will be so much greater, whether they find it in, you know, you name it, you know, Catholicism or you know, Asatru or Hinduism or whatever it might be. To be open to this and to be aware of the inner transformation that can come from everything around you, and stay focused on that goal. You know, we have the survival of our people in the balance over these next couple decades. And always keep in mind how you can seek out the stability in your life and the partners that you need to allow you to be part of that fight.
All right, Patrick LeBrun, thank you again for coming on. We'll add links to your writings at countercurrents.com. Great show, something different, something touching back on the old stuff. So great having you on. Thanks. Yeah. And thanks for letting us into this portion of history. It's too very interesting. I think a lot of people learned a lot of new things today. So thank you again for being generous for your with your time, Patrick.
And thank you very much for doing everything you do at Red Ice and allowing this to happen. So thanks again.